For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later in the hour, we're going to be hearing a fun interview from 2007, housed in the morning show archives. It's about a book called The Songs of Insects, and we're replaying it today to help celebrate National Wildlife Week. But first, a wonderful surprise. Yesterday morning, I was able to record a brief interview with documentarian Ken Burns. On several previous occasions, I've had the great pleasure of speaking with his younger brother, Rick Burns, a fine documentarian in his own right. But this was my first opportunity to speak with Ken Burns, who, of course, has helped to reshape the whole notion of what a documentary film can and should be. And his marvelous legacy includes such magnificent documentary series as The Civil War, Baseball, Jazz, The War, Prohibition, The Roosevelts, the Vietnam War, country music, and most recently, a marvelous documentary series devoted to one of the most important and influential writers of the 20th century, Ernest Hemingway. This documentary series is airing right now on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. Ken Burns, one thing that I have heard you say about Ernest Hemingway is that he kept everything. Can you explain to our listeners what that means in terms of the treasure trove that you and your colleagues got to explore, and to what extent it was actually a challenge to make sense of all that was available to you?
This was a kid in a toy store for us. I mean, he did save everything, and the story, a sidebar that we don't go into in our film, all of his papers, all of his manuscripts are at the Kennedy Library in Boston. So you can see the 47 different endings that he had for A Farewell to Arms, arguably his greatest novel. He made carbon copies of every letter that he sent out, and people kept their letters, and they're now in the umpteenth volume of the collected letters of Ernest Hemingway. And there you can see the unpolished him. You know, he's talking to a wife, he's talking to a son, he's talking to a friend, he's angry, he's sad, he's anxious. And that helps to penetrate the mythology of Ernest Hemingway, which is so big and so wide and so kind of impossible and opaque to get to. But it allowed us to see what a disciplined writer he was. You could see that, you know, his prose is spare, and it starts off spare and even, and then he edits it even more. And he's diligent. He gets up every morning at first light and works until, you know, early afternoon, and then stops for the rest of the day and is a great dad to his three sons. But it is just an amazing process. And to have that helps us, for a visual medium, make the act of of writing come alive. It's such a singular, solitary, to some people, boring, like watching the paint dry or the grass grow. But it's not, because with new applications, we can remove some of his corrections, if you will, remove in quotes, and then re-add them back on. So it's like you're looking over Hemingway's shoulder as he's editing one of the most famous paragraphs ever written, the opening paragraph of A Farewell to Arms. That's the first shot of the film. You're watching him, you know, do these edits. It was fascinating. I mean, he was an 18-year-old ambulance driver in the Italian Alps, serving the Italian army against the Austrians in World War I. He gets blown up practically. He's got 225 pieces of shrapnel in him. You go to the Kennedy Library before COVID, and there's the shrapnel. He saved it. He had the pieces of metal that was in him. So you're sort of stunned at the ability to get beyond the mythology and get to the actual man himself, who, despite that kind of macho image, is sensitive and vulnerable and empathetic and self-critical in really beautiful ways. And he begins to understand why his writing is so great and why he's arguably the greatest American writer of the 20th century. He influences every writer who's come after him, and he's admired around the world for this kind of spare American prose. It's just a great story.
It's as though he reinvented writing itself, in revolutionary ways. You've already hinted at the fact that he is a complicated man and in some ways deeply flawed, and someone who did not always behave with kindness to those closest to him. Could you just say a word about the challenge of trying to describe this aspect of Mr. Hemingway in a way that would be honest and yet fair to him?
Yes, well, that's the key. I think your question houses the whole thing. We live in a culture that wishes to flick an on or off switch, and you can't do that. And so you cannot find even the tiniest flaw and eliminate someone. And his flaws are so glaring. His behavior is so reprehensible and inexcusable that you have to find a way to not excuse, but to then understand and also weigh as well all the extraordinary things he did, the times he's generous, the times he's loving, the times he's caring, the times he's devoted, against all the stuff. We tend to, right now, in a kind of binary computer world where it's all a one or a zero, it's all a zero-sum game, right? You just go, nope, that's not good, bad, and then you dismiss. And so you can't do that. You don't do that to yourself as you see your own contradictions. You don't do that to the people closest to you as you see theirs. You learn a kind of tolerance of withholding the judgment that we all sort of think we want to make right away. You do the judgment, and then life is devoid of what life is all about, which is complication. I've got a neon sign in my editing room in cursive, and it's in lowercase, and it says it's complicated. Because filmmakers, if they got a work, they don't want to change it. And we want to change it. We want to find out new information that takes that A-plus scene and maybe makes it a B, but is accurate. And then maybe by making it accurate, those B-plus scenes on either side of it are suddenly A's. So you just don't know, and you have to be willing to find out new information. You know, people research for a set time, then write for a set time, produce a script that informs the shooting and the editing, boom, done. We never stop researching, and we never stop writing. And it makes our process longer, but it permits us to be corrigible to the end. That is to say, willing to say, oh, that's not right. Let's change that, and let's make it right. We learn something, new scholarship, or we learn a new perspective, and it seems like our emphasis is too much on that. We're putting our thumb on that scale, and really this one deserves the emphasis. Or you find a new photograph or a piece of film or a piece of music that makes something cohere. You know, it's really, I love my job. I mean, I just think I've got the best job in the country because it educates all of my parts. And all it is, very simply, is telling stories and trying to sort of avoid the facile judgments that we make. Oh, he's good. Oh, he's lousy. Oh, he's, you know, this or that.
Right. You're challenging us to release our assumptions and pre-assumptions, even as you challenge your own assumptions and presumptions. And
that's right. I have to leave my baggage at the door to begin this project. In fact, my baggage is on some carousel in some city. I haven't seen it in 8 years since we agreed to do this film. whatever it was, my preconceptions about him, because everything you think you know about Ernest Hemingway is wrong.
Mm.
And you have to do it. And so rather than tell you in our film, you the viewer, what you should know, that's the last time I checked, that's homework, we'd rather share with you our process of discovery. That's a different way of doing it. It's like, hey, I got this story I just found out. Now, it turns out it took 6.5 years to do it, but that's what our storytelling process requires. But I think you'll be riveted by the story of her, and you can't look away, even as it gets, you know, more difficult.
I agree.
The demons are catching up to him.
Yeah, what I have seen already is indeed riveting. In our last minute, I want you to tell our listeners about the amazing privilege you had of going to his home in Cuba.
Well, Lynn did that. I drew the short straw on that, and she went to Cuba twice. She went to scout it with one of our associate producers, and then came back with a crew and filmed the Finca, which is his farm outside of Havana. And it's a beautiful mountaintop place, and it's just filled with all the lush tropical stuff you'd imagine. But when he left, he didn't expect to be leaving for good on the eve of the Castro Revolution. And so the liquor's still in the liquor case. The records are still on the turntable. The little penciled notations on the tile in the bathroom next to the scale of his weight are still there. And it is a ghostly place. And they filmed there for a couple of days, and what they brought back with the incredible cooperation of the Cuban government, because they don't let people do anything but kind of look in, you know, the stuff. They took the ropes down, and we had the run of the house, is you'll see it. You'll feel it. It's like he's there. And when you talk about he's writing Old Man in the Sea, you see the place where he was writing, and it's alive, and it's great, and you've got the still photographs that put him in it, the old archival ones. It's just a great privilege. I've felt that all my life. I always talk about the ghosts and echoes of an inexpressibly wise past. You feel it when you stand on a little round top at Gettysburg. You feel it when you go to the Lincoln Memorial. You feel it, you know, in all the places that we go to, the battlefields and locations where the human beings that we've trained our lenses on lived. Hmm. And Hemingway's no different. And maybe, perhaps, even more, you feel his presence. The ghost of him is so present there.
Ken Burns and Lynn Novick are responsible for this marvelous film, Hemingway, airing now on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. Mr. Burns, thank you so much for all that you've given the world, and best wishes with your future projects.
Thank you so much. That's so kind. Great to be with you.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And now, in honor of National Wildlife Week, a morning show interview from the archives that dates back to 2007. And that is the sound of the Springfield cricket. And it is one of many, many sounds to be found on a special companion CD to a wonderful little book called The Songs of Insects. And in it, we are taken out into the wild and given, one after another, some of the most beautiful sounds to be heard in nature, with a number of different crickets and trigs and katydids and cicadas and much more.
And I'm very happy to be speaking for the next few minutes with one of the co-authors of this book, The Songs of Insects, Lang Elliott, who has a number of such works to his credit, that is, book-CD combinations, including Common Birds and Their Songs, Music of the Birds, and The Songs of Wild Birds. And this is an absolutely wonderful collection which he has put together with Will Hirschberger. It is published by Houghton Mifflin, and it is beautifully appointed not only with the companion CD, but with brilliant color photographs of each and every insect whose song is collected here. And we will speak with Lang Elliott for the next few minutes about this wonderful book. Lang Elliott, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, Greg.
Really glad to talk with you.
Yeah.
One thing that might be really kind of interesting right off the bat is to have you tell our listeners your credentials for doing this kind of thing, because you don't really exactly come to it with that piece of paper hanging on the wall that some might suspect.
Not really. I went as far as a master's degree in science. I actually studied chipmunks in the Adirondack Mountains, chipmunk behavior, social behavior and foraging ecology of the eastern chipmunk. But then for the last 15 or 17 years, I guess, I founded a small company called Nature Sound Studio, and I focused more on natural history education, but having to do with natural sounds, the songs of birds and frogs and insects and mammals, and restricted also to North America. So neither Will Hirschberger, my co-author, nor I is an entomologist. We actually arrived at this through our interest in sound recording and the sounds that we were hearing.
And your collection of bird songs is also, in a sense, put together by someone who's not a, is it the word ornithologist?
Not an ornithologist, no.
Well, we should stop talking about what you're not and talk about what you are, and maybe talk specifically about how your professional life ended up taking this detour away from the common chipmunk.
Well, it's an interesting story. I did my master's degree and then spent time in the Adirondack Mountains. I was a ski tour guide, a nature interpreter, and a nature guide, and I picked potatoes. I did all these different things when I was up there. And then I ended up moving to Ithaca, New York. And for 5 years, I worked at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, but in bird photography. And then I just got this idea that, well, you know, why couldn't I go out and do recording, sound recording, and start putting together some guides myself, and which I did. So I left the lab in 1988 and did a lot of traveling, mostly collecting recordings of the sounds of birds. And then I produced a few guides, Know Your Bird Sounds, Volumes 1 and 2, and a guide called Wild Sounds of the North Woods. And those were able to make enough money to keep the whole thing going. And then here I am, 17 or 18 years later, still doing the same thing, and having done a number of guides, like the Stokes Field Guide to Bird Songs was my creation. And then I've done 4 books through Houghton Mifflin, 3 bird books, and then this insect book. And actually, right now, I'm speaking from back porch of Carl Gerhardt's house in Columbia, Missouri, overlooking the Missouri River. And Carl's a herpetologist at the University of Missouri, and we're working on a frog and toad book.
Wow.
For the frogs and toads in North America.
Very good. You know, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I remember something that we have on our shelf back home is an LP, and I don't know who produced it. For all I know, maybe you did or had a part hand in it, but some kind of a collection of the sounds of frogs. Uh-huh. And I can remember every so often, just for kind of a change of pace, we would put on this LP of frog sounds. And uh-huh. In particular, there was, I remember it was, I think, the last band on the first side was actually the scream of a frog. Uh-huh. A frog maybe being attacked by a snake or something. And
it
I remember,
could have been the alarm call of a pig frog, a southern frog. And when you pick them up, they just scream like crazy.
That might be. But I remember that our collie, I mean, would just sit there very quietly through all these other frog sounds or songs or whatever they were. But, boy, when we got to that uh-huh. last band and the frog scream, boy, her ears would perk up, and she would be very, very concerned about that, almost as though the scream of an animal really connects with other animals in some sort of way.
Yeah, I think it's universal. In fact, probably why the frog does that is to attract an animal that would scare whatever has a hold of it, might be scared by the approach of a human or another predator, and they would let go of the frog, and the frog would survive.
Fascinating. You mentioned in this particular book, again, it's called The Songs of Insects, that you've actually, in a sense, I'll put it this way just to be humorous, but you've actually kind of lifted the title of your book from an earlier book of exactly the same name.
Yeah.
But you've stolen it for a very good reason, let's say.
Yeah, we mentioned that in the book. The original work was a scientific work published by Harvard University Press in the 1930s, by Charles Peirce, who was the first scientist to study insect song in North America. That book, of course, has been long, long out of print, although you can still find copies. And we like that title, so we pay tribute to the book in our introduction and use the same title.
Very good.
Yeah.
So where did these recordings come from? Who gathered them?
Will Hershberger and I gathered all the sound recordings and virtually all the photographs in the book ourselves. And I live in Ithaca, New York, and Will lives in West Virginia, actually near Hagerstown, Maryland. So we both did a lot of recording on our own home ground, but then we periodically met up with each other and went on extended field trips, like as far east or far west as Missouri, and we went south down into Florida and up the coast and north into Canada, just listening and trying to record and photograph all the species that we considered common, widespread, you know, and easily heard, the things you're most likely to hear when you're outside, especially in the summer, from midsummer into the autumn until the hard frosts come. That's the time of the singing of the insects.
Generally speaking, are we listening to the sound of the very katydid that is photographed?
I didn't quite understand the question.
I mean, like if I turn to page 10 and there's such a katydid, is the sound on the CD, is it exactly that katydid? I don't mean just that type, but...
No, I would have to say in some cases we were able to photograph the insects actually singing. And in some insects, they assume a certain posture, hold their wings up when they sing. But in a tremendous number of insects, you don't really see much when they sing. Like they wiggle their wings very quickly, and if you took a picture of it, you might not realize that the insect is actually singing. So we didn't make a special effort to do that, except for those species that assume obvious postures when they sing, like tree crickets that hold their wings straight up, or ground crickets or field crickets that also elevate their wings.
So I guess I was wondering then about the matching up of a sound with a given insect.
Yeah.
I mean, when you record a given cricket, I mean, are you close enough that you are seeing it in action and know for certain that it emanates from that particular kind of cricket?
Quite often not. We were able to identify everything by a mixture of approaches. We would home in, like on a singing insect that we didn't know, you know, that we already didn't know, using directional microphones, like shotgun microphones.
Right.
Or you can get the end of the microphone often very close to the singer, like a cricket that's under a leaf or hidden away a bit. And then we would try to collect the insect so we could see it, because often they sing at night and they hide when they sing. And if you shine a light on them, they'll hop away or go into a burrow or go under something. So we would collect the insect, which sometimes you could just pick it up by hand. Sometimes we had to use a net. In the case of some of the ground crickets, we even used aspirators, where if you saw it for a second, you could stick a little tube down there and then suck it into the tube so that we could then see what it was we had. And then identify it either by visually, using keys that allow you to key these things out, or in some cases we actually identified species by the sound. There's a website called Singing Insects of North America. It's a put together by a scientist at the University of Florida, Tom Walker. And there's little snippets of sound in there that allowed us to match up a number of species and say, well, this is what we have. And that's because, like, sometimes the species is easy to identify visually, but in some groups, like the ground crickets, they all look alike.
Right. When I look through these pages and pages of katydids, too,
yes.
I mean, sometimes it is the smallest of details, and maybe
yes.
in some cases, maybe not even anything that's really all that visual at all to distinguish them.
Yeah,
but it might be something like their song that might really be especially distinguishing.
Yes, the katydids, a number of them are unique in appearance, if you know what to look for. But there is like one group called the bush katydids, the genus Scedaria, where the different species are told apart primarily by their tail plates, their reproductive organs on their posterior, and you really sort of need to look with a magnifying glass or lift the wings so you can and pull the tail aside a little bit so you can actually see the structure.
Hmm.
So it is very difficult. When I was doing the Scedarias up near my home in Ithaca, New York, I was quite confused at first. I was collecting specimens. Like, what do I have here? Which one is it? And then finally I caught on to it, how you can, like, look at the tail plate and which part of the tail you're looking at to look at the appropriate structures and identify the species.
Interesting.
Because at that point, I didn't really have I hadn't discovered the online guide, Tom Walker's online guide, and I didn't have recordings of all of them, and it was just, it's like things can be a mass of confusion, then all of a sudden you catch on and it clarifies everything.
And suddenly you feel a little more like an entomologist than when you began.
Yeah, somewhat, you know.
You've just mentioned the fact that this book is really designed with, in a sense, the common person in mind, and in some ways it's helpful that you and your co-author Will Hirschberger are not entomologists, I mean, but coming at this, in a sense, as very, very interested outsiders, and it helps you to put together the book in such an approachable way. Describe to our listeners who might take up this book and open it up to, for instance, the long-spurred meadow katydid, what exactly they see on each and every spread in this book.
Well, our book covers 77 species altogether of crickets, katydids, shorthorn grasshoppers or locusts, and the cicadas. And each species has a page spread. So when you open to that species, you'll see on the left a picture of that insect actually photographed on white. It looks like it's standing on the page. And we did that so that when you finger through and compare species, you can really see what they look like in a way that's not confused by what they're sitting on.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, especially with these katydids, because
yes.
obviously what makes them especially intriguing is their wonderful capacity for camouflage.
That's right.
And to see them against the stark white means we really can easily make out every bit of what's visible to the eye.
The individual character of that species. But then on the right-hand side, there are pictures of the insect on vegetation, natural pictures. So you see it both in its habitat, but also on the white. And there's a range map so that you can figure out if it's in your area. And then some basic natural history information along with a fairly detailed description of the song. And all these songs are songs of the males, primarily, anyway. Used to attract females and, in some instances, repel other males, a territorial function.
Well, and it's interesting how you map out the song itself, and that makes the listening to the CD a little more interesting in some ways.
Yeah, we include sound pictures or sonograms, and we did it for two reasons. In some cases, they are very useful to give you a visual while you're listening. And in most cases, I think they are. In other cases, it's just a nice ornament. For instance, you have a lot of tree crickets that have continuous trills, and really the sonograms all sort of look alike, except that the time axis may be a little different for the different species. the quality of sound may be different, but you can't tell that really from looking at the sonogram. So it was a mixture. It makes the book more appealing. It gives you a visual for the sound. And then in many cases, it is actually an aid in helping you identify the sound.
Absolutely. Now, for instance, the aforementioned long-spurred Meadow Katydid.
Meadow Katydid.
Which is number 37 up here. And I think that means it's track 38. Am I right?
If it's number 37, it's track 37.
Okay, let's see if you're right about that. I'm going to bring that on right now.
That's a pretty high-pitched one.
Yeah, okay, well, hold on to yours, everybody, and here we go.
A lot of people may not be able to hear it.
Okay.
Long-spurred meadow katydid, or Kelimum sylvaticum.
And the chart that you have on this spread shows us that the clicks begin in slightly slower fashion and then speed up into the more standard.
That's actually a clicking, and then it turns into a shuffle. Yeah, that's one of the, many of the meadow katydids have very high-pitched songs. That one goes from about 8 kilohertz up to above human hearing. Mm-hmm. And in some of the species, like there's one called the short-winged meadow katydid, which is actually an excellent test for somebody's hearing. And in fact, it's so high-pitched that only people with excellent hearing or you know, kids would be able to hear it well. And
is
as you get older, a lot of adults would not be able to hear that insect at a distance where they're likely to encounter it.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Give us a couple of your favorites in the book. I mean, songs of insects that you think are especially beautiful, and we'll give
especially
a quick listen
beautiful.
To them.
Or interesting. Yeah, my favorite in terms of beauty and actually story potential is the snowy tree cricket.
Which number is that?
This is track 11.
Mm-hmm.
And I could give a bit of a preface. It gives a series of chirps, and you can count the chirps very easily, and you can actually approximate the temperature in Fahrenheit by counting the number of chirps in 13 seconds and then add 40, and you have approximately the temperature in Fahrenheit. As it gets hotter, it'll speed up its song.
Wow.
Yeah.
Here it is, the snowy tree cricket. Oh, I didn't have to say that because the narrator is going to do that.
That's right.
Anyway, here we go. Oops.
Acanthus fultoni. Songs of a warm male followed by songs of a very cold male.
That one's at about 72 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay.
And you'll hear one that's about 56 or there.
And it will be slower?
Oh, yes. Coming up shortly.
Wow.
Yeah, it's giving about one song a second, and so over 13 seconds, that'd be 13 songs. 40 plus 13 would be 53, and I think it was around 55 or 56.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It's a very, very striking difference. I mean, sometimes you read about such things, and yet you fear that it'll be such a subtle difference that it's
right.
Not something that ordinary folks can detect. But that's absolutely clear and unmistakable.
Like all the insects have some relation, their song has some relationship with temperature, so there's many insects that you could use to calculate temperature if you knew what the formula was. Mm. But generally anything that's repeating slows down, and there may be also a slight lowering of the pitch of the sound. And it turns out like there's the ear of the insects are temperature tuned, so that like a snowy tree cricket that's warm hears other tree crickets singing fast and knows that's a snowy tree cricket. But then when it gets cold and the song slows down, so does its perceptual template, I guess you could call it, still recognizes its own species, even though it sounds different than it does when it's warm.
Fascinating. There's still that recognition that, this is a friend. This is a colleague.
And there's other species, like there's a ground cricket called the Allard's ground cricket that has a sort of a slowish trill. It's very musical. And then the way you tell it from the tinkling ground cricket is that the tinkling has much slower notes, slow enough that you can count you know, the individual pulses. But a cold Allard's will sound much like a warm tinkling. But, of course, you never encounter the two together, you know, because when you hear them out in the wild, there's only one temperature, so they are different from one another.
We should mention that although we've talked a lot about crickets and katydids, which are relatively common, you also have in this book several examples of something called trigs. Now, I know a little bit about insects, but I didn't recognize this term.
They are a type of cricket, actually. They're in their own group, and they're extremely tiny, like a third of an inch long or quarter of an inch to a third of an inch. Some of them are very beautiful. There's one called the handsome trig that's pretty common in the East. But most people would never see them because they would be hearing them, but they wouldn't see them because they're so tiny that you just wouldn't notice it. For some of the trigs, like there's a trig called the Colombian trig, and the way we were able to collect them was to you'd hear them at night singing from a tree, and then when it came to the morning, you'd spread a white sheet under the tree and then sort of shake the tree. And then look on the sheet and see if you could pick up some trigs, and that's the way we got some specimens for photography.
Very interesting. Let's listen to the Colombian trig.
Handsome trig.
Oh, handsome, sorry.
Pulcellus.
It's sort of a stumbling, grating trill.
You know, it's so interesting. I hate to talk over it, but a lot of these at just first listen might seem very similar to others, but you listen to this, for instance, and it has its own particular array of colors and mix of pitch, and all of these songs are unique in one way or another, even if some very strongly resemble others.
Yeah,
I mean, that variety, if we just take a moment to really listen for it, is just delicious.
Yeah, it's a challenge. Like, some species stand right out, you know, as being unique. There's nothing else like it, like the common true katydid or the oblong-winged katydid. But then there are groups that are what I'd consider very difficult groups, like the continuous trillers. There's a number of ground crickets that have a fairly continuous trill with subtle differences, and among the tree crickets, there are actually a number that have continuous trills. And you have to learn the difference. It's hard to describe, and there would be confusion on those. But then, you know, a number of things stand right out.
Right.
The cicadas all sound clearly different from one another, even though they share certain similarities. And many of the katydids are quite unique in the sounds they make.
Hmm. We probably should spend just a minute or two with the cicadas, since at least in this part of the country, we are seeing cicadas for the first time, of course, in many years, as is the way it works with this intriguing insect.
Yeah, the 17-year periodical cicada is emerging around in the Chicago area. I think it gets southern Wisconsin, and that'll happen at the end of this month, or I guess early May, and that'll hit the news headlines for sure.
Absolutely. Do you have a favorite cicada we should listen to?
Well, there's two that I really like. One is the scissor grinder.
I'm glad you said that. I turned right to it and was intrigued by the title. So
it has the quintessential pattern that cicadas have of starting out soft and getting louder and then gyrating, you know, or modulating, big modulations in sound and petering out at the end.
Let's listen.
Scissor grinder cicada, Tibicen pruinosa.
Yeah, that's a pretty common species in a good portion of the east, not the northern areas. It probably does make it to Wisconsin.
Almost. The map shows it's a near miss, actually.
I know it's in southern Michigan.
Yes, absolutely, and in almost all of Illinois and so on.
You would up there have Tibicen linnaei, which sounds similar, a little higher in pitch and faster, but the same kind of pattern of soft and then growing louder and then pulsating.
Mm-hmm. Did you say you had one other favorite cicada?
Well, it's the 17-year periodical cicada, which sounds really different from all the others.
Is this track 75, Linnaeus's 17-year cicada?
Yeah, it has like a sound. If you get close to a male, it sounds like wee-ah, wee-ah. But if you behold a huge chorus, it's just a din of sound.
Mm-hmm.
You can't hear the individuals.
Okay, let's try it.
Linnaeus, 17-year cicada. Magis cicada, septem decem. Listen for the female's wing flicks in response to the male's song. This is followed by courtship song. And finally, the marvelous droning chorus of a woodland full of these magnificent cicadas.
Now that's music to my ears, but some people might not agree. Here's a courting sequence. When a female is right up next to her. Next, we'll hear the chorus, which is what most people would hear.
Because
you're up in the treetop. Yeah. Constant din is loud. They're so thick where they come up. So much.
Takes one's breath away.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so interesting. One of my most potent memories of cicadas is when I'm at Ravinia, which is the summer home of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, kind of like Tanglewood out in New England.
Yes.
But my word, in a summer where there are cicadas, I mean, it is this competing music, if you will, that really gets frustrating when you're there to listen to Wagner. But,
right.
But it's really quite intriguing. Tell us what you can. You've already touched on a couple of clear answers to this question. Why it is that insects sing? Do we know very much about that?
Oh, yeah. What our book covers are the singing insects, where the males produce a song that is used to attract females. And that includes the crickets, the katydids, and as I mentioned, some of the grasshoppers, the short-horned grasshoppers, that are technically should be referred to as locusts, and then the cicadas, which shouldn't be referred to as locusts. A lot of people call the cicadas locusts, and that's not really correct. And in all cases, the males have organs that have evolved specifically to help them produce a sound that's going to attract their mate. In the case of the crickets and the katydids, they make sounds with their wings, specifically their forewings. At the base of their forewing, one wing is modified. It has a file-like structure. And the opposite wing has a scraping structure, and so they are rubbed one against the other, like a scraper against a file. And that's what's producing the sound, which is amplified by the membranes on the wings. So if you watch a cricket chirp, it'll elevate its wings, and you'll see a little rapid vibration each time it chirps. And the same with, like, the tree crickets that hold their wings straight up. And then you'll see them just vibrating like crazy as they make their sounds. So that's the way the crickets and katydids produce sound. The short-horned grasshoppers or locusts that's called stridulation when it's a sound that's made mechanically in that way. The short-horned grasshoppers rub their leg against a wing. Like a fiddler, you know, they're actually fiddling to make their sounds. The cicadas have special organs called timbals at the base of their abdomen, and there are membranes inside the timbals that are vibrated that create these incredibly loud buzzing sound that then resonates through their tracheal system, producing the loudest of sounds of all the insects. And surprisingly, their ears are actually right next to the timbal. So. You would think they would go deaf, but I'm sure there's some depression mechanism.
They get some headache, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And you've touched on the fact that in some cases this is for courtship, that kind of thing. But is that mostly it? Or sometimes do insects just seem to do this for, I don't know, the pleasure of it?
Well, I think that you know, we have sex to procreate, but is there pleasure? Of course, that's what makes us do it. So my idea, you can't get into the brain of the insect to know what it's feeling, but I figure that, you know, the birds singing and the frogs singing and the insects singing, of course it's pleasurable. It makes them want to do it. On some level, it is a pleasure, but it has a scientific function, and that function is in the insects primarily to attract mates. In some species, also to keep other males away, you know, a territorial kind of function. Probably in all the species, there's at least a territory that, you know, an area right around the insect that if another male came into there, there would be a scuffle or a fight. But the really primary major function is to attract females.
Hmm. Well, certainly whatever pleasure they get in producing these sounds, we get a whole lot of pleasure in listening to them, and especially as aided by your wonderful book, which, again, has beautiful full-color photographs and just enough information for us to understand that each and every one of these specific insects, and, of course, this companion compact disc in which we can hear a wide range of wonderful sounds from these intriguing creatures.
Yeah, we're quite excited about the book. It's the first practical guide to the identification of insect songs in North America.
Very good.
Both visual and auditory.
The book, again, is called The Songs of Insects. It is published by Houghton Mifflin. And again, from Houghton Mifflin, there is also a similar sort of book devoted to the song of birds. Which I also have on my shelf, by the way, and have enjoyed very, very much. And Lang Elliott, I'm really glad we had this chance to talk about your very intriguing book, and I hope we get to talk again sometime. My thanks to you for
Thank
this
you,
very intriguing and enjoyable talk.
It's been a lot of fun.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'll be speaking with a faculty colleague from Carthage College, Dr. James Ripley, Director of Instrumental Activities. He's going to be conducting a band concert at Carthage College this Friday evening. And for the first time all year, there will be a music performance in which parents and siblings of the members of the bands can actually be sitting in the audience enjoying the concert in person. It's Carthage's first step towards allowing the public in to physically witness its musical performances, something tightly restricted because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And because Dr. Ripley sits on Carthage's COVID Coordination Committee, we will find out from him a bit more about the committee and its deliberations and its plans for the fall, when Carthage is intending to return to entirely in-person education. Also tomorrow, again for National Wildlife Week, we'll be hearing from the archives a conversation with the author of a book called Where the Birds Are, talking about some of the parks and national forests in America where one can go to see an amazing array of birds. Speaking of birds, on Friday, it's Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program, and her special guest will be Mariette Nowak, the author of Birdscaping in the Midwest, a guide to gardening with native plants to attract birds. And this is a wonderful opportunity to learn about what you can plant in your own backyard to attract the most beautiful array of birds. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock.
The program is archived at our website, WGTD.org, and is available as a podcast. Be sure that you search for the proper title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. The podcast version, available 7 days a week, is available from Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts,